Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation and Regulatory Transparency Project, was recorded on Friday, October 11th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a book review on The Capitalism Paradox, How Cooperation Enables Free Market Competition. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us our moderator, Professor Susan Dudley, who is the Director of the GW Regulatory Studies Center and Distinguished Professor of Practice at the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration at George Washington University. Professor Dudley will be introducing our author today and asking him several questions about his book. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Micah. I am very pleased to be here with my friend Paul Rubin. Paul is the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor Emeritus of Economics at Emory University. Callers may recognize his name because he's published widely. He served as president of the Southern Economic Association, and he's just an all-around interesting person. So we're going to be discussing his new book, The Capitalism Paradox. I really enjoyed reading it, and I'm finding myself talking to people about it and applying its insights to a lot of different observations. I think it's particularly timely because the animosity towards capitalism seems to be on the rise. Recent surveys suggest that most Democrats and millennials think socialism is a better economic system than capitalism. The Democratic presidential candidates are distancing themselves from capitalism and endorsing expansive policies that would dramatically restrict economic freedom. And President Trump himself is also pursuing policies that restrict economic freedom, international trade, and immigration. So, Paul, my first question for you is, given all the evidence that links economic freedom and human welfare, why is it that so many people reject capitalism and market systems in favor of greater government control?
This is a question I've been thinking about for many years. I must admit, in the past, I was worried about overregulation, but in recent years, as you just said, it's become really scary. It's become much worse, the hostility towards capitalism. And there are a lot of factors in it. I don't have a complete answer. One thing is I think people do not really understand economics very well. People have what I call a zero-sum mentality thinking about the world. So instead of worrying about what can we do to make growth occur, what can we do to make the pie larger, people tend to think of how can we divide the pie. They assume that the amount is of income or money is fixed, and they look and they say, well, some people have too much, so that must mean that some people have too little. So there's that zero-sum thinking, which really pervades a lot of the discussion in the news these days. And that's one thing. Another thing that I address in this book is something that we economists do wrong, I think. And I think we economists overemphasize the competitive nature of the economy. A capitalist economy is really much more cooperative than it is competitive. The heart of a capitalist economy is the transaction, and both parties benefit from a transaction. That's the essence of a voluntary exchange. And since both parties benefit, we can view the act as being cooperative. Competition plays an important role in choosing the actors, because in competition, the most efficient actors are the ones that engage in transactions, but the transaction itself, the cooperation, is much more efficient. And one thing that struck me in writing this book, I did a bit of a Google search about competition and words that modify it, and I'm just going to read a few of them. For Google references, for cutthroat competition, there's 250,000. For excessive competition, 160,000. For destructive competition, 100,000. Ruthless competition, ferocious competition, vicious competition, unfettered competition, all have thousands of references. For beneficial competition, there are only 16,000 references. For beneficial cooperation, there are 550,000 references and almost no negatives. So people hear that the economy is competitive, and then they think competition is bad. Competition The metaphor competition really comes from sports, which is a zero-sum activity. There's a winner and a loser, but the economy is not zero-sum. You know, everyone can gain as the economy grows, and yet people have this incorrect view. So I think two things. One is the people view the competitive economy as being negative, and secondly, the economy really isn't competitive. It's really much more cooperative than it is competitive. And if we economists were to stress the cooperative nature of the economy, I think we could alleviate at least some of the hostility towards markets if we were to try to do that. A quick example, I use the example of Walmart. So when Walmart comes into town, if you think competitively, you say, aha, Walmart has driven all those small merchants out of business. If you think cooperatively, you say, aha, Walmart has done a better job of cooperating with its consumers than the small merchants, and by being a better cooperator, it's done a better job of entering the market and benefiting consumers. So that's one important theme of this book, is that we should really emphasize more the cooperative nature of the economy and less the competitive nature of the economy.
Did your Google search include looking for cooperative capitalism, or is that just would there be one site?
No, I just looked. I didn't look. I guess I should have. I didn't look for that. I just looked for cooperation and beneficial cooperation.
Right. Yeah.
Not cooperative capitalism yet.
Yeah, I suspect you wouldn't see much, other than people referring to your book.
Right, which they should do.
One of the things that you say in your book, you explain why this is so, why we have this zero-sum thinking. And you talk about our ancestors, and you have written other books that look at the evolutionary origins of law and politics. And in this book, you say political thinking was important for our ancestors, but economic thinking was not. Would you walk us through that and distinguish political thinking from economic thinking?
Well, if you read the sort of the discussion of primitive societies or societies of our ancestors, the economics was very simple. There wasn't much division of labor, not much economic growth. There was some specialization, but mainly by gender and by age, but not much specialization. So there really wasn't much of an economy to understand. On the other hand, politics has always been quite important. Even if you read my colleague Franz de Waal's study of chimpanzees, even in chimpanzees, politics is important, forming coalitions and so forth. So I think if you think that our minds have evolved to solve the problems that were common to our ancestors for long periods of time, political problems were much more salient than economic problems. And so I think that's it. I think politics is much more zero-sum than is economics. There's a winner and a loser. In politics, motives are important. What does the president, what does the king want? What does the dictator want? In economics, motives are very unimportant. As Adam Smith showed us, even with the invisible hand, even selfish motives can lead to very good outcomes. And of course, people miss that all the time. I write about the drug industry, and people say, well, the pharmaceutical companies are just out for profits. And of course, to an economist, yeah, they're out for profits, but the way to make profits is to make drugs that cure people. But we think of them politically, what's the motive of the companies? And we say, aha, the motive is incorrect. So by thinking politically, we often get things wrong, and we miss some of the important features of an economy.
And you also talk about the politics is conflict, us versus them. Talk a little bit about that and why economics is very different.
Right. So in politics, as I said, there's competition. There's one party or another, or international politics. President Trump has unfortunately made a big deal of this, the Americans versus the Chinese, and they're taking our jobs. But from an economic perspective, of course, if the Chinese sell us stuff, we're benefiting because we're buying stuff and they're producing it. And the trade is what's beneficial, the trade between us and them. So it's really not a competitive situation. It's really a cooperative situation. But by viewing it as us versus them, as competitive, we get the wrong attitude. And really, trade has two things against it. First is the zero-sum nature of the world, of the thinking. And second is the us versus them. So we think the number of jobs is fixed. And we think that they, the Chinese in this case, are taking those jobs from us. And so it's a double-edged sword. For many years, economists had convinced others that that wasn't true, and for many years tariffs kept going down and trade kept increasing. I think President Trump has done some wonderful things with respect to deregulation of the American economy, but his trade theories are really, unfortunately, really incorrect and based on zero-sum thinking, I believe.
And related to that, it is still the political thinking. Politics is about competition for resources, while economics is about cooperation to generate surpluses. So that's your zero-sum thinking again.
Yeah, exactly right. Politics is let's see what we can get, as opposed to let's see what we can produce. A book called Pie Economics, where I talk about economics of dividing up the pie versus economics of growing a bigger pie. And, of course, politics is more about dividing up the pie. When you read debates about taxation, for example, you say, well, this will help the rich or this will help the poor. No one talks about this tax policy will lead to more growth than some other tax policy. That seems to be nothing that's politically salient to most voters.
Yeah, and, you know, it's related to James Buchanan's, you know, rent-seeking versus profit-seeking. In a world where politics drives decisions, you have a lot of rent-seeking, which does probably bring you to zero-sum outcomes, winners and losers, whereas in economics, you know, or a capitalist system, profit-seeking leads to surpluses and innovation and a bigger pie.
Right, and it's actually a little worse because rent-seeking probably leads to a negative-sum outcome
mm-hmm.
because you're spending money on rent-seeking rather than on productive things, and so that money is basically wasted. And so it's really a negative-sum game rather than even a zero-sum game.
So let me ask you, the Business Roundtable a couple months ago issued a revised statement on the purpose of the corporation. Now, I read that as I was reading your book, and I interpreted it as consistent with your notion of cooperative capitalism, and that, of course, within the capitalist systems, companies succeed by cooperating with their employees, cooperating within their communities, and, of course, with their customers, as well as their owners. But it has definitely faced a lot of blowback, including from people who I respect. So I'm really curious what you think.
I think it's right that people cooperate on all those terms, but I think the ultimate purpose of the cooperation is to increase shareholder returns. So even though those things are important, I think they're all subsumed if the purpose of the corporation is to maximize shareholder wealth. And I think if you start to try to think about those other things, well, maximizing shareholder wealth leads to efficient use of capital resources, which are always scarce. And if you try to throw in other things, if you really try to do them, you're going to reduce the returns to capital and you're going to, I think, lead to more inefficiency. So even though the cooperation involves all those things, and I think they're all important, but I think they're all subsidiary, really, to the fundamental purpose, which I think should be the Milton Friedman view that it's they should all be aimed at achieving the maximum returns for shareholders because that's the best way to increase. Well, now you can talk about them, and if they only talk about them, then it really won't affect their behavior much. But I don't know quite what it means to say they're to say that they're equally important.
Senator Elizabeth Warren actually sent BRT a letter within the last couple of weeks saying, if you really mean what you say, you should sign on to my Accountable Capitalism Act. I don't know if any of the CEOs have done that, but one, I'll just, in case listeners haven't been reading about it, her bill would require employees to elect 40% of a company's board of directors. For companies of $1 billion or more would have to get a charter from the federal government in order to operate. And they would have a duty to create, quote, general public benefit for stakeholders as opposed to stockholders. Have you looked at her platform and what do you think about that?
I've only looked at it briefly. I have trouble reading it. But I think it would be, in general, a disaster. I mean, going to state chartering system has led to useful competition between states. And I said competition is often very useful in picking actors, and it's led to competition between states to generate the kind of corporate laws that people want, which is to say the efficient set of corporate laws. If we go to a federal system, then we have a monopoly system, and there's if it's wrong, there's no way to correct it. Putting workers on the board, I think, is harmful because that will lead to, again, to inefficient use of resources. I mean, workers are very important, but they're protected by the marketplace. If someone tries to underpay his workers, it's simply true that workers will go somewhere else. And right now we have a tremendous economy for jobs, so it's easy for workers to move if they don't like what's happening. And I think that will provide much more protection for workers than putting them on the board. I don't know what it means to create value for stakeholders besides stockholders. It's just, again, creating value for stockholders leads to benefits to stakeholders, to everyone, because it leads to more wealth in society, and greater wealth in society can be used for all the kinds of things that that we might want. I happen to live in Sarasota, where there are a fair number of wealthy people, and we have great public amenities because people contribute money to theaters and roads and set and all kinds of things here, all because people have made money in the market system, and they use that money in all kinds of ways. We have the Gateses giving away and Warren Buffett giving away billions of dollars a year of money that they have made in the market system. So I think we get the things that she wants, but we get them in a much better way than we would get them by government.
So what do you say about people's concerns about income inequality, and that the levels of incomes for the poor and middle class can be so different from, say, the people in Sarasota?
I think then we're back to zero-sum thinking. If total incomes were fixed, and someone, if Bill Gates is rich, then if total incomes were fixed, if we were in a zero-sum world, that would mean that he got rich by making someone else poorer. But of course, he did not. He got rich by developing computer systems that we all use and that make us all hugely better off. And it's true of, you know, rich people get rich basically by being productive. We economists have a theory that earnings are based on productivity, and I think that's right. And so that people who are rich because they do something productive. And we're seeing right now, because the economy is doing so well, we're seeing median incomes go up, incomes of workers going up. So inequality would go down. But I don't think a worker, you know, I really don't care about inequality. I don't care that Bill Gates is richer than me. I care about what I can do with my money and how much money I have. And I think that's the natural thing for an economy. So, you know, I think the publicity that talks about inequality is reinforcing a zero-sum view of the world, saying, well, they're rich, you must be poor. And I think that's just completely wrong and harmful to really emphasize.
Is the fact that that is so appealing, does that also reflect on our hunter-gatherer brains and the way we evolved? Because we do tend to compare our situation with someone else's. And so the relative income or wealth matters, even though, as you say, maybe it shouldn't, because we're all doing better as a result.
I think that's right. I think in a hunter-gatherer world, incomes were relatively equal, and people had duties to, and not duties, but it was efficient to share resources, for example, to all get together and hunt a big game. So in that world, if you became rich, it probably was because you were doing something wrong. You were shirking your duty or engrossing too much resources. And so I think we still have that kind of mentality a little bit. And so when we hear about rich, we still think our hunter-gatherer brain comes in and we say, he must be doing something wrong. And so we, excuse me, we still have that way of thinking about things. But I think we can learn not to. And I think, you know, if we realize the economy is cooperative rather than competitive, then we would say, well, Bill Gates is rich because he really did a really good job of cooperating with consumers and cooperating by developing Microsoft and all the benefits that have come from Microsoft. And similarly with Steve Jobs and most of the other multi-billionaires we see out there really done something useful. And we like the useful things they've done, but we don't realize that the returns they have, the money they have, is because they have done such useful things.
And my guess is that, say, Senator Sanders or Warren or Representative AOC would all say, yeah, we get that, but still, they don't need that much money.
They do pay, you know, taxes. They probably don't need that much money, which is why they're giving it away. You know, Bill Gates has, and many others have signed this 50% pledge where they agree to give half their wealth to charities. And in a sense, they have to. I mean, there's, you know, when you've got $1 billion, you can't spend it. There's no way you can spend $1 billion or $5 billion. And so there's nothing to do with it but give it away. And that's in fact what many of the wealthy are doing. So I believe they're probably much more likely to do an efficient job of giving it away than the government would be if it took it and tried to give it away. Of course, Professor Senator Warren has proposed a wealth tax, and wealth taxes just don't work. Several countries have tried them, and they don't work. For one thing, rich people can put their wealth in forms that are hard to value. Just think about a rich person dying and the estate tax, and it takes many accountants and lawyers and maybe a few economists 5 or 10 years to evaluate the estate so they can figure out how to tax it. If we're going to do that every year with every rich person, we would be spending way too much resources simply evaluating things and not really getting nearly as much money as we would expect to get from it.
So let me just ask you, one of the things I found interesting in your book was your notion of horizontal competition but vertical cooperation. And you said of all the millions of firms in an economy, a firm will compete with a small number and cooperate with the rest. So that cooperation is much more common than is competition. Could you just talk to us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, think about, say, the auto industry, which is, I think, an example I use. There are maybe now a dozen auto firms competing with each other. But each of those firms hires huge amounts of inputs, huge amounts of labor. It sells to consumers. It buys electricity. It uses highways. In a way, every transaction in a modern economy ultimately involves millions of people, and every vertical trend, and they're vertical, all arrangements, all of them are vertical. They're hiring or they're selling. Or I give the example of a worker. A worker probably may compete with another dozen workers for a job, and so they're competing with them, but they're cooperating with all the other workers in their firm and in the economy and in the marketplace. So there's a limited amount of competition, huge amounts of cooperation. I mean, by vertical, you can really think of the entire economy as going into any simple transaction. As you think about capital and building machines that are used, I use the, you're buying a Coke, you have the Coke machine, which is built by machines, which have been built by other machines, and there's electricity involved, and there's the banking system for the credit card or the currency that's used. So any transaction involves a huge amount of other entities all behaving cooperatively, and only a few other competitive entities, a few similar firms that you're competing with, but you're cooperating with everyone else, which is why I say cooperation is much more common in the economy than is competition.
Actually, the autos is an interesting example, because the auto companies actually, they were concerned that fuel economy standards issued during the last administration were too strict, that they wouldn't be able to meet them. But now they're saying, oh, but don't reduce them too much. We still want you to regulate us. What do you think about that behavior?
Firms often want, large firms especially want regulation, because basically it harms small firms. I was once at a meeting where a congressman was saying, well, we're talking about privacy. But he said, well, we got all the players involved. We got Microsoft and Apple and Facebook and Amazon, all the players involved. And I said, yeah, but the people you want to get involved are the new guys that aren't even in the market yet. And all the big firms have an interest in keeping those guys out, so they can use the government as a method of controlling competition and reducing the possibility of new cooperators. And I suspect something like that is going on in the auto case as well. It's trying to make it harder for new people to enter the marketplace.
Yeah, so cooperating with the government regulators maybe isn't the type of cooperation that you're arguing for.
That's exactly right.
Without further ado, we'll go to our first caller.
Good afternoon. My name's Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society. And I'm very glad that we're having this particular teleforum. I wanted to ask Professor Rubin and Professor Dudley to think about a sort of contemporary view, which is, to put it very simply, that what we call the global economy is moving away from market freedom and is becoming more and more a matter of government control and national champions like Airbus, and also that economics is becoming a tool or a metaphor for simple political questions like great power competition. And we may not like it, and we may wish that we were back in the 1960s, but we're not. Things have changed over the decades. And that in response to this, the only thing that we can do in the United States is to essentially visualize our own economy as a survivor of cooperative market capitalism. That is to say, because we have one system of laws, because we have a continental economic system, because we are generally a relatively unified, homogeneous society and culture, that we can continue to stand by values that Professor Rubin and Professor Dudley and Adam Smith and Milton Friedman would all recognize, even though the European Union, China, and other global economic powers are really moving in a different direction, if not the opposite direction. Do you think that there's any basis for saying something like that?
That's an interesting question. It does seem like that's happening to a certain extent, but we should keep in mind that if we can maintain free markets and free international markets, which we aren't doing as well as we could, but if we could maintain free international markets, those other guys could do whatever they want, and they will be, basically, if they become protectionists, they will be hurting their own people much more than hurting us. Again, the purpose of an economy is goods for consumers to consume, and if China keeps their prices low, they're really benefiting American consumers more than they're harming them. And so if we keep that in mind, we could let the rest of the world do what it wants, and it wouldn't be good for us, but it wouldn't hurt us nearly as much as it would hurt them. When the EU keeps out American firms, for example, they're just penalizing their own consumers, and that's something it's sad, but it's not something that really affects American consumers all that much. And so I think you're right. We should maintain our current system and hope that the rest of the world understands its benefits. But if they don't, that's more their problem than our problem.
But if we are a free market surrounded by predatory nation states looking to assert and increase their political power through economic and, of course, military means, how do we protect ourselves except by doing what President Trump is in fact doing and imposing tariffs?
Well, again, predation is a very funny thing. If they're predating by selling us stuff at below costs, that's really to our benefit and their harm. Military is a separate thing, but to be militarily powerful, you have to be first rich. And, of course, we're still the richest economy there is. So we can afford whatever military stuff we have to do. But in terms of predation, things like predation, if they're selling us stuff cheap, then we should take advantage of it and buy it cheap. It really is our benefit, even though I think President Trump, unfortunately, doesn't understand that, but he should. The Chinese don't understand it, but they're involved in a very different economic system, which doesn't care much about consumers, ultimately.
Paul, are there things that we haven't talked about that you think are worth emphasizing?
We talked about the zero-sum. An important thing is the zero-sum nature of much thinking. Since this is a Federalist forum, I thought there's a couple of things about the legal system I talk about. For example, I think lawyers, at least in their litigation function, are much more focused on the competition than maybe many others, because a trial is at least in the short run, is a competitive sort of thing. It's really a zero-sum thing in the short run, who wins and who loses. And so lawyers may miss the cooperative nature of transactions. Transactional lawyers may understand them, but talk a lot about negotiation. And the purpose of negotiation is, first of all, to get a better price, but also to figure out which party can do a job most efficiently. So they may negotiate back and forth who will do which function in a contract, and that's a way of figuring out the efficient form of the contract. What Richard Posner has shown is that even though in the short run trials may be zero sum, in the longer term trials will set precedents, and if it's done right, then the precedents will be economically efficient and will lead to efficient future transactions and efficient future rules. So the law can become efficient, even though it appears to be competitive in the short run, it can become efficient or cooperative in the longer period. So, and I talk about different kinds of contracts. I talk about capital contracts, for example, which can be very, very complex and appear to be one-sided, but in fact can be. But lawyers talk about bargaining power a lot, but economists don't talk much about bargaining power. We think of the world as being driven by markets, and a contract may look one-sided, and so people may say, well, that benefits the seller because he has more bargaining power. But in many cases, a buyer, for example, may want a one-sided contract because it enables him to promise that he will perform some function. So I think the reliance by lawyers on bargaining power is a short-run thing, and really it's much more markets are more important than bargaining power in determining the terms of a transaction. So that's one thing that's in the book that might be relevant.
Yes, I actually did find that very interesting. And you had some specific examples, as I recall, that the party to the contract that may look as if they're the ones with the weaker hand, in fact, it's benefiting them because they are able to demonstrate that they will fulfill the contract.
Right. You know, if I'm a new firm in the marketplace, I may want to convince others to hire me. And one way to do that is to make very strong promises of what will happen if I don't fulfill the contract.
Mm-hmm.
A large penalty, for example, and I may want to do that because I want to convince others that I'm likely to fulfill the contract. So if you just look at the simple terms, you may say, aha, it's one-sided, but in fact it's a result of a decision on both parties to try to make sure that the contract will work. So I have some examples of that as well.
Hi, yes, this is Neil Chilson, and I have Professor Rubin, I'm very excited to read your book, and I joined a little bit into the call, but I was curious if in your book, or if you could maybe riff on this if it's not in your book, you talk about the types of competition cooperation that we think are good and the types of cooperation that are bad. You already brought up the example of cooperation perhaps with your competitors in order to have regulators do things that sort of cement the market power of your companies. And obviously these types of questions are really hot right now, given all the questions around antitrust and big tech in particular. And so I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about how we distinguish good cooperation from bad cooperation in the capitalist context.
Cooperation between competitors is often inefficient. If you read economics textbooks, in fact, you come away with a view that cooperation is a bad thing, because the main kind of cooperation they talk about in at least principles textbooks is cartel-like cooperation, where firms cooperate to form a cartel and overcharge consumers, the kind that the antitrust law deals with. And I think those are generally inefficient and should be penalized one way or another, although, again, we sometimes underestimate the extent to which there are incentives for cartels to break down of their own weight as people cheat. But nonetheless, those kinds are inefficient. As I say, the sad thing about the way we teach economics is when a student gets done with the economics course, he may think cooperation is a bad thing because the only cooperation he's really read about is cooperation between competitors to cartelize the market. We economists really don't talk about the cooperative benefits of exchange as much as I think we should, and I think that's a very neglected topic in teaching economics. But I think it's very, very important to realize that most things are cooperative and not competitive. speaking of teaching economics, I have a bit of a digression in the book where I talk about the way we teach economics, going back to Susan's initial point about students being socialist. I think we economists are partly to blame for that. These people who are socialists are our students, and I think we economists who teach economics haven't done an adequate job of explaining the benefits of the market. I think as economics becomes more and more mathematical, which is good, I'm not criticizing the mathematics, but as it becomes more mathematical in the research, it's also becoming more mathematical in the teaching, and we turn off many students who might be interested in economics and might learn about the efficiency of markets, but they don't take the course because it's not there. At the graduate level, it's even worse. I always have students who are very interested in economics and often have very good economic intuition, and they want to get a PhD, but I have to tell them that unless they do a lot of math, there's no real place that they can get a PhD in economics and get a job in economics. So even though I think the research that we do is useful and valuable and even very mathematical, I think we should still maintain some level of ability to teach intuitive economics, teach people, and I say we should teach them the simple economics of socialism and why it's a very inefficient system. And our courses are designed not to do that sufficiently, which is why we get, I think AOC was actually an economics major somewhere, and yet she's apparently a dedicated socialist. I think that's sad that one can go through a undergraduate economics program and come away with that. So I think there's something that we're doing wrong there.
All right, and this may be a short one, but there's we're hearing a lot of talk now about regulating the social media giants on antitrust grounds, concerns that they're not protecting users' privacy. And I think your conversation with Neil about contracts, et cetera, made me think of this. What do you think about that and the contracts that we who use Facebook and other social media, are we being taken advantage of, and what should be done? Are they too big?
I don't think they're too big. You know, we saw, no one mentioned an example, but Google, which is not a small company, tried to go into the competition with Facebook with, I forget the name of the program, but it failed. So I think they're sort of natural monopolies. I don't worry so much about them. I don't worry. I've written about privacy, and I don't find it. You know, people are trying to find out what I want to buy so they can sell it to me. I don't mind that. I think it can be helpful. I am a little worried about the ideological homogeneity of them, and people say that sometimes they exclude conservative thinkers or one class of thinkers. And I know some of the websites I read, which may be extreme, but nonetheless, I find them useful. And some of them are being challenged as being too conservative or too politically too hateful, and so some of them are being blocked out. And there is apparently a tremendous homogeneity of beliefs among the people that work for these companies, and I find that more concerning. But I don't know what to do about it. But I don't find the antitrust issues to be terribly important. I don't find the privacy issues to be terribly concerning myself.
Professor, I heard your answer to an earlier question. It seemed to miss at least half of the equation with the Chinese, which is not just that they sell us things cheaply, but they erect barriers to us selling things to them. They steal intellectual property and so on. You don't believe that that's a serious impact on this country in an economic sense? We're running up a huge debt with them, and I believe that's what the president is trying to counteract here. Am I missing something?
Now, the intellectual property issue is, I think, an important issue. I'm not sure that the tariffs are the way to counteract that, but that may be what he's trying to do with his tariffs. Traditionally, tariffs are used, and if you listen to him, he sometimes talks about them taking jobs and so forth, and there I think it's a mistake. If we are aimed at having them honor intellectual property, then I think that is that it would be, to the extent that they're taking our intellectual property without paying for it, that would reduce the incentives of our firms, inventors, to create intellectual property because they're not getting the full return on it. So I think there is something to be said about that. I, you're right, I didn't talk about that. I didn't talk about it in the book either. But I think we would like to maintain the value of our intellectual property. And I don't know quite what to do about it. I mean, China is a apparently is a very, very widespread violator of intellectual property. And I say I don't know how we can, what we can do about that. And maybe I don't think a tariff is the best way to do it, but perhaps it is. Perhaps there's no other alternative.
But what about their tariffs and other trade barriers that they've erected to us selling to them? That doesn't concern you?
No, that doesn't concern me. That just means they're harming their own consumers more than they're harming us. I mean, they're denying their consumers the right to buy our stuff. Our, you know, our producers would like to sell to them, and it would be good if they could, but the Chinese are really harming themselves more than they're harming us by erecting those barriers.
Well, I guess I just have to say you and I completely differ on that point.
Well, we tend to view international trade in terms of benefits to producers, and we say, well, we want to be able to sell. But really, the benefits of international trade are reduced prices to consumers. The stuff we sell to the Chinese is really the cost that we have to pay for getting stuff from them. So if we don't sell them as much stuff, that may be bad for our firms, but it doesn't hurt our consumers much. It hurts the Chinese consumers much more.
Well, I'm curious, Paul, given all this, and you said your thoughts have even changed as you wrote the book, are you optimistic that capitalism can survive despite its increasingly negative reputation as immoral and all those other adjectives you gave us at the beginning?
Well, as you said, when I started writing the book and started even thinking about this topic, I've been writing about it off and on for a few years, my thought was we have too much regulation. But as I wrote the book and as the world has changed around me, I am now more concerned about the survival of capitalism. I mean, I have a new book coming out called Student's Guide to Socialism, where I try to explain the long-term effects of socialism on someone's life. But, you know, Joseph Schumpeter, the great economist, talked in his book Capitalism, Freedom, and Society, talked about how intellectuals and descendants of rich people would push towards a non-capitalist economy, towards a socialist economy. And I'm scared sometimes that we're really moving in that way. I think if we adopt socialist policies, this country will become I don't think it'll become Venezuela, but it could certainly move in that direction. And what's amazing is you just have to look around the world. You look at Venezuela, you look at North Korea, you look at East Germany, you look at the Soviet Union, and wherever there's been socialism, it's been a disaster. Sanders talks about the Scandinavian countries, but they've given up on socialism. In many respects, they're more capitalist than we are, and they get angry at Sanders because they say, we're not socialist countries. We've given up on that. We tried that, and it didn't work. So I've come to the conclusion that if we talk about democratic socialism, which Senator Sanders talks about, the only advantage of democratic socialism is that the people can ultimately vote out socialism when they find out that it doesn't work. But I don't understand why we would want to move towards a system that has been a complete universal failure everywhere it's been tried. And as I say, I blame economists a little bit for not having taught that sort of thing to our students, so they'd come away without realizing how bad socialism has been wherever it's been tried. And I'm sometimes afraid that we're going to move in that direction here.
On that pessimistic note, Micah, I turn it back to you.
All right. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank both of our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.